there's a lot for us to unpack in this discussion. These are sensitive topics, both in a scientific and a philosophical sense, conversations around the mysteries of consciousness, of psychic abilities, life after death. You know, these can be polarizing conversations, but my personal belief, my personal intuition is that we're fast approaching a time where science and spirituality, or physics and metaphysics, are beginning to occupy more of a shared space. They're beginning to come closer together, and I believe that a symbiosis between these two ways of observing reality is in some ways perhaps an evolutionary development for humanity. It's the next step in evolution, so to speak.
I absolutely agree with that. I think we can't, we're to a point where I think we can't divide, you know, the physical concepts of life and consciousness and who we are with who we actually are. And the fact that we are, you know, sentient beings connected with the entire rest of the universe. And we're seeing more of that all the time, I think. And new inroads into, you know, into science and into technology is showing us that more every day. The combination or the influence that consciousness has on physical matter. And, you know, we can, and this is now becoming something that is, you know, can be proven quite easily. And there are still those who call themselves scientists who would dispute that and say, no, it's all in your brain and everything else, and, you know. But anytime you have a scientist who completely disregards something, that's not a scientist. Scientists should be open to question and open to investigation and inspection.
Well, you're in a unique position because you occupy a role as an instructor on what is essentially extrasensory perception, or what people might call psychic abilities, and you're doing so for a scientific institution with historical involvement with the U.S. intelligence community, namely the CIA, U.S. Army Intelligence, regarding the research and potential application of extrasensory perception. And before we get into your work with the Monroe Institute of Applied Sciences and the concept of remote viewing and the historical interest in these methods from the U.S. intelligence community, can you just take us through how you ended up in such a role in the first place? Because from what I've heard, your backstory is quite unique. It includes five separate near-death experiences, which I imagine had a significant impact on the direction that you took in life.
I mean, those are the most important events of my life. And you are the realities. I'll sort of back up and give you, you know, a background of this. I come from I grew up on a farm in the middle of the prairies in Canada. And my mother had eight girls in a row. And then she figured out what was happening and she changed her dials and she had three boys. And I'm the 10th out of 11. So it's almost redundant to say that we were Catholic. All right. I think some of the most significant things, and we grew up basically impoverished. We had, you know, other than, you know, our big garden on the farm, we didn't have money. We didn't have a lot of things. But the most important thing about my background, I think, is I've had several near-death experiences. And I drowned when I was 12 years old and had this amazing experience. But when you're 12 and weird stuff happens, you go, that was weird, and you go on with life, right? And I didn't pay much attention. It had definitely changed me in significant ways, but I didn't really pay attention to it when I'm 12 years old. But there, you know, and I had a car accident. I was involved in a really violent car accident when I was 17 and lost a kidney and a hockey career. And later on, a bunch of years later, I got involved in politics and had a heart attack in the middle of a hockey game when I was playing an old-timers hockey game. And I died in the ambulance and was brought back in the hospital. And, and had a couple more after that. There were another car accident and another heart attack, if you will, and which were so profound and so life-changing. So, but one of the things that occurs to me, like people will say, well, five times, you know, and like I'm thinking, well, you know, I think the problem is if you show a 12-year-old that there's no such thing as death, that's dangerous. Because after that, it would be, it sincerely, changed me, but it would become like, why wouldn't I do that? Here, hold my beer. What's the worst that could happen? I get killed?
Right.
No. So it really did open the doorway to an expression, if you will, or trying to enjoy every aspect of life, and that can be dangerous for, for 12-year-olds or for anybody. However, having said that, I mean, I'm not talking about, the pain of being smashed up in a car accident or a heart attack or something like that. But I would not trade those events for anything. They were so substantially powerful because it told me, or it showed me who, who I really was. I had another experience, if you will. I'll put it into sort of a perspective. I'll just quickly tell you about the drowning when I was 12 and how that really changed everything. And I was 12 years old, and we were living out in the prairies in Saskatchewan, and wide open, there's not much around. And we had these ponds, or we used to call them dugouts and sloughs in the prairies. And this one Saturday afternoon, we had our cousins from the big city of Edmonton, Alberta, were visiting. And so we ended up out on the, a couple of miles from our farmhouse, racing around, chasing gophers, that kind of thing. And we came upon a pond where the neighbor's kids had abandoned a raft of some sort. And my little brother and I, and my two cousins, we had been told, my little brother and I especially, have been told, to stay away from these ponds because we couldn't swim a lick. We didn't have a clue about swimming. And so, of course, the next thing we know, we are all four on this raft in the middle of a 15-foot deep pond, bouncing back and forth. And my older cousin thought that it would be fun, considering that we were ter my little brother and I were terrified of water. He thought it'd be great fun to rock the raft. Well, if you wonder why you've had no bad luck in your life, it's because Murphy lives with me, all right? And so I fell into the water. I fell off this raft. And it was the most remarkable thing because I didn't even attempt to dog paddle. I just thought, oh, no, I'm screwed. And I sank to the bottom of this pond, probably, I think, 12, 15 feet maybe. And I could eventually feel my feet sink into the mud on the bottom, but it must have kicked or pushed because I began to float up in the water. And I could tell that because the water was clearer, and I could, almost see. And whether my head broke the surface or not, I don't know. But I began to sink again a second time. And the most amazing thing happened. I had always, and we've had this experience in our lifetime. At some point, we have had a drowning, suffocation experience in a pond, in a lake, in the ocean, in a swimming pool somewhere, and where you suck in a big gulp of water and the instant panic that takes over, and it's like thrashing about, and well, that's sort of what I expected. But what happened is, on the second time after imploding to the bottom of this pond, all the air went out and the water came in, and it was absolutely peaceful. The reality is, I mean, we spent the first 9 months of our lives in a liquid environment. So it was like totally peaceful. My lungs were functioning, but they weren't bringing in oxygen, they were bringing in water. Or at least that's my estimation of it. But there was absolutely no discomfort, or I don't know, discomfort, but there was no threat, or didn't feel like any, And so, and that really kind of surprised me. And I'm thinking, wow, I thought it'd be a lot worse than this. And I'm sinking to the bottom. Well, what happens? Because there's no, I'm breathing water in and out, but there's no oxygen. So, excuse me, eventually, we just simply go to sleep or lose consciousness, and everything faded to black, or faded, to darkness. And I'm not sure how long I was gone, but at some point, I became aware and snapped back into it, sort of with a jolt. And I'm still in the water, but everything has changed. And I seem to be in this bubble of energy completely surrounding me. But inside this bubble was every color in the rainbow. And all of these colors were vibrating. And it was very sensual. And, but each color felt different. Like green felt different than blue, and blue felt different than orange and yellow. And I was just so amazed. And I'm literally on my knees in the mud at the bottom of this pond, running my hands through these colors, thinking, oh my God, I didn't know you could feel colors. And it penetrated right through my body and just had this vibratory experience. It was just so amazing. And I began to think, this all took place very quickly. And I began to think, hey, this is weird. Am I dead or am I dying? Is what occurred to me. But the only reference that I'd had at that point in my life to, I didn't know anybody that died. The only reference I had in my life at that point was I had read the book Tom Sawyer a few weeks before this happened. And in the book, Tom is believed to have drowned in the Mississippi, and he returns to the back of the church for his own memorial service or whatever, if my memory is correct. And I began to think about that. And the next thing I know, I went shooting out of the water, and instantly I'm floating over the choir loft in the back of our Catholic church out in the country, this huge empty building. It's Saturday afternoon, right? Floating over the seats in the choir loft on the second floor of this building, looking down over it and thinking, holy crap. Hey, if this is my funeral, where is everybody? My mom and dad would probably be here, my brothers and sisters. There's nobody there, but I'm floating. And I'm thinking about this thing. Wow, Tom Sawyer didn't float. He didn't fly. I'm flying. And I discovered that just with my own thoughts, I could control where I floated to. And sometimes I floated over the edge of this, looking down 16 feet, and it was like, whoa, And I'm not sure how long this all took. It seemed like a few minutes. Apparently, I was in the water, under the water for 6 or 7 minutes, according to my cousins, who saved my life. And at some point, it was like somebody kicked me in the stomach. And the next thing I know, I'm on the shore of this pond, and I'm upside down. My cousin has got me upside down, basically. My face is bouncing in the mud, and he's pumping the water out of me. And I probably vomited, and coughed out water for a couple of minutes. And, that was not particularly enjoyable. But afterwards, we just sat there with big eyes and thinking, oh my God, what just happened? And so we knew we'd be in huge trouble. So we made this pact that we're never going to tell a human being about this. And then we walked really slowly this mile and a half or 2 miles on the way home to let our clothes all dry. And it was interesting. And we're walking along, and I'm telling my cousin Brian, who had saved my life, who could swim. They had big swimming pools in the city of Edmonton. And I'm telling him about this in about, flying in the church, and he just literally said, Tom Sawyer, Jesus, we thought you were dead. And so I learned that other people, maybe didn't appreciate that aspect of it. But we got home, and we weren't home in the yard for 10 minutes or so. And the next thing I know, there's some kayaking and cussing coming out of our house. And two kids got a good whipping on that day, and I was one of them. Yeah, that'll teach me to die, right?
How dare you?
Now, that event significantly changed me, but I didn't realize until I was an adult how that had changed my life. I just thought it was just a quirk of, growing up on the prairies. I seemed to know things or understand things. I could find things that were missing. And, I didn't give this a lot of thought, but my sisters and my family could verify that, because it became almost a common thing where they would, I could find stuff and I could see it in my mind. And so it'd be like my sisters were saying, Well, ask Paul, see if, and and sometimes they thought I was the one who took it, right? And sometimes I did, because that's how you build your own legend, Yeah, look over here, excuse me. So it was, but I really didn't put a lot of stock in. It was just a weird quirk. Just one other incident that sort of probably as much as anything mystified and changed my whole perspective on life. When I was about 2 years after this happened, when I was about 14, we had my little brother and I were, as I mentioned, we were Catholic, and we were altar boys in the church. And every Sunday, we'd notice as people were arriving, parishioners were arriving for the services, there was a pair of turkeys, wild turkeys, in the churchyard, and you could hear them gobbling and whooping about and stuff like that. And so this one Saturday afternoon, a couple of years after the drowning incident, I'm walking home from my cousin's house and walking past this big old church. And there's a big line of trees, about 80 feet high. And on top of one of these trees was this huge nest. And I thought, my 14-year-old brain thought, oh, that might be the turkey nest. I didn't know turkeys can't fly. All right. And so it was probably an eagle's nest or something like that. But undaunted, I crawled up this. I thought, I gotta look. And so I crawled up this 80-foot tree or whatever it was. And I'm getting close to the top, going through the branches. And I'm at the top, and I'm standing on my tiptoes on a branch. And I'm close to the top of the tree. And the nest is right above me. And I'm hanging onto the branch where the nest is, thinking, ooh, this might not be a good idea. If there's a turkey, what if it pecks me in the face? Or maybe there's babies in there. And so I'm pulling on this because I got to look and see inside, and I'm on my toes. And all of a sudden, the branch that I was standing on broke, and instantly I went falling through this tree. But fortunately or unfortunately, about 10 or 15 feet down, I hit a bigger branch, and it knocked me unconscious. And like I'm hitting branches and falling and hitting branches and falling. But the amazing thing is, I was watching myself fall through the tree, hitting branches. And it was just sort of stunning to me. And I'm actually like in the tree looking down, and finally my body landed, I landed on my back, and it knocked all the wind out of me. And it was like boom, And I'm in the tree looking at myself saying, get up. And holy crap. Afterwards, I'm laying on the ground as soon as I became conscious on the ground again, looking up into that tree, thinking, how in hell did that happen? How was that possible? I watched myself fall out of a tree. There's some kind of a metaphor for that, I think. It was such an for me, it was such a stunning, amazing occurrence, because that had never happened before. I watched myself, being knocked unconscious. So that, of course, stuck with me, for the rest of my life, obviously. But what happened, now I should, later on in life, I mean, I was, I was, excuse me, I spent about 10 years in broadcasting. I was a rock and roll disc jockey back in the 70s, and then got into news. I was a news announcer and newscaster, even for CTV, which is one of the national networks. Excuse me. And after about 10 years in politics, I got into, in broadcasting, and got into politics. And I was the mayor of a city for a bunch of years in a small city in Saskatchewan. And when I had this heart attack in the middle of the hockey game, and I died in the ambulance on the way to the hospital, and had this profound experience. And that pretty much changed everything. I was about 41, I think. And after that, I began to have spontaneous out-of-body experiences. So I would find myself floating at the ceiling of my bedroom, wondering what in hell happened. And I had, back in around 1981 or so, I had read a book. I saw a television interview with a guy named Robert Monroe. And in this interview, he was talking about this book that he had written called Journeys Out of the Body. And I thought, that's interesting. And so I went to the library in our little city and I borrowed this book, Journeys Out of the Body. They had it. And I read it from cover to cover and I took it back and I thought, that was cool, but this guy's a nut job, you know. And took it back and never thought about it much for the next 10 years, even though the little things like that happened to me when I drowned and when I was falling out of that tree kind of haunted me a little bit in relationship to this book. But I just, you know, I was a busy man. I had to, you know, I was a businessman and a politician. And and then all of a sudden, I began to have spontaneous out-of-body experiences. And one of the first things I thought about as I'm floating at the ceiling over my bed, looking down at myself and my wife sleeping in bed, one of the first things I thought about was Bob Monroe. And I thought, holy crap, he wasn't crazy. Wow, this is real. And so I went on to, you know, so after the very first experience, the first thing I did and the next morning is I headed back to the library and found out that Bob Monroe had written another book called Far Journeys. And so I borrowed it and found that they had this, that Bob had created, he had been a businessman, and in fact, a fairly prolific and famous man, if you will. Bob was an executive producer of radio shows back in those days. We're talking back in the 50s. And he had actually created the show, you know, the, goodness, I can't remember the names now. Various old radio shows, but this is before television. And he had, you know, amassed a certain degree of wealth and, you know, so on and so forth. So when he wrote this book, you know, it became sort of an instant success around the world. And I'm not sure, but he may have been, other people called it astral projection. Bob may have been the one who created the terminology out of body experience. And, The Shadow, that was one of the shows that he had created. And so I discovered that he created this place in Virginia where people from around the world could go to, and he had developed this technology that he called hemispheric synchronization or hemisync, a special, actually patented technology, in which they could actually control, listening on stereo headphones, could control your brain waves and take people to deep, profound levels of consciousness, where ordinarily you would be sound asleep. And they called it mind awake, body asleep. And, you know, and so I thought, I have got to check this out. And they had what they called their gateway program. So I headed off to Virginia at the first opportunity, and took this program called Gateway. And I went back several times because I fell in love with the place and the whole possibilities around it. Exploring your own consciousness in a very conscious way is very powerful no matter what you do. But when I was there, and I returned a number of times, and when I was there, I got to participate in what they call the isolation chamber or the lab, and got a few times, got to spend time, you know, hooked up to the brain scan and, you know, so on and so forth, the diodes and, you know, and monitoring brain waves and things like that while I was there. And some of the experiences that I had, some of the things that I told them about, there was a microphone hanging in the room and have headphones on, and the monitor would be actually talking to me. So, and there was this fellow named Skip, and he was the lab techie, and you know, and he would come on the microphone over, you know, in the headphones, as I'm dropping into some deep place, and he would say something profound while I'm completely, you know, gone, if you will, and he'd say something like, "Tell us what's happening," and it would jolt me out of this, and. At any rate, some of the things that I shared with them, some of the experiences that I had, got somebody's attention. And at some point, I was introduced to some really interesting people that I met. And one of these folks was a guy named Dale Graff. And it turns out that Dale was the Pentagon director of this formerly top secret program called Stargate. And I heard about what they were doing, and I thought, you know, I might have been born in Saskatchewan, but it wasn't yesterday. I thought it was bull. And then I discovered that this guy named Skip, who was the lab techie at the Mineral Institute, Skip Atwater, that he was actually used to be called Captain Fred Atwater. And he was the manager of this top secret program called Stargate at Fort Meade in Maryland. And then things began to make sense to me. And I thought, holy crap, you know. But I wasn't so sure that I, you know, they had this concept that, understanding, if you will, in those early days when they developed this through the CIA and Stanford Research Institute in California, that people that had had near-death experiences seemed to have an aptitude for it. And I think in their thinking was that, you know, these people could retrace those steps into the psychic or spirit world, if you will. And there may be some truth to that. But I think more than anything, I think that you cannot possibly have a near-death or an out-of-body experience without going through it a million times in your own mind. And the more time you spend in here, the more you understand how you process thought and where thought comes from. And I think that was, you know, sort of a more relevant, you know, at least my take on it. And so what they did in the military is they put out the word through the different divisions, Air Force, Army, so on and so forth, Navy, said, hey, have you got any guys and gals that they've been blowing up or something and now they're talking weird stuff? We want to talk to them. And they, you know, developed and recruited a number of amazing, you know, significant people in this project. Now, where this all came about was back in the early 70s, the American CIA had intelligence that the Soviets had trained psychics who could spy in America. They could literally sit in a darkened room in Russia and describe events that were happening, in the America, or describe missile sites and so on and so forth. And they thought, wow, if that's true, how do we defend against it? So the only thing that they had ever dealt with before, they had some previous work or interaction with some of the scientists or physicists at the Stanford Research Institute in California. And so they headed off to California to ask these physicists, who at that time were Russell Targ and Hal Puthoff for their names, if this was possible. And of course, Targ and Puthoff thought, yeah, probably. And so it begs the second question, is how do we defend against this? And they said, good luck, you know. But it begged the third question, which was, is this something we could do? And of course, you know, the physicists thought, hey, government contract. And so they said, sure. And so the longer story short, they were given a special contract with CIA at the time to do, I think, an 8-month study. It was something like $50,000 or $55,000 to do an 8-month study into seeing if they could produce or develop a program that could defend against the Russian imposition, or was able to counter it in some way, or to do their own thing. And at that time, they were working, CIA was, or Stanford was working with a couple of very significant and powerful psychics, if you will, doing psychic research. A guy named Ingo Swann and another guy named Pat Price. Ingo Swann was a psychic and artist from New York City, kind of an extravagant kind of person. And Pat Price was a former homicide detective from Los Angeles. And the two of them together put together a program, where mostly it was Ingo Swann who understood or who hypothesized that we are always connected to a larger context, to all consciousness. And all we have to do is to sort of move away from all of the physical aspects and down, you know, to get control of this aspect of ourselves, that part of us that, and we've all experienced this. And when we say something like remote viewing, and this is what they ended up calling this program, which basically is the ability of every single human being. It's an innate ability that we all have to be able to describe in detail, accurately, in their words, any person, place, thing, or event in history. That's pretty big. But it's the ability of every human being, because we are not just these physical bodies. We are connected to the consciousness of everything. And by removing some of, or taking away, or dumbing down some of the physical aspects, we are able to move into that place where we can accurately move into all different states of consciousness connecting to everything. And so they put together this program, which is sort of a left brain occupying possibility. And it's kind of like, and we've all had this experience. We might be sitting somewhere, might be sitting in a park, might be sitting at the mall or whatever. And we get this, you get this sense that somebody's watching you, and you turn around and sure enough, there's somebody. What part of you knew that? What part of a mom knows her kid's in trouble 3,000 miles away? That's the part that's connected always to consciousness and to the rest of the universe. And so they put together this protocol, they called it, called remote viewing. It probably is a misnomer, should be called remote sensing. And developed this protocol in which they could take trained psychics or trained personnel to accurately describe any person, place, thing, or event in history. So, or for that matter, in the future, looking at future events and things like that, with remarkable success. They ran the program, excuse me, for around 23 years, and until it got leaked, I think in 1995 or 1996, I'm not sure which year it was. And when it got leaked, and it was like New York Times, Chicago Tribune had headlines like, you won't believe what the government's been doing. They've been training psychics as spies, you know. And the giggle factor sets in. And when you've got a top secret program and everybody knows about it, it kind of, you know, deflates it. So CIA came out in typical fashion and they said, yeah, we've been doing this, but it really doesn't work that good. And so we're going to quit doing it, right? And so they defunded the program, ostensibly. And so what happened in my relationship to all of this is I was hired at the, because I met Bob Monroe, you know, while he was still alive, and Bob and I got along really well, and because we were into the same thing, we're into broadcasting and, you know, kind of politics and stuff like that. But I was hired as a trainer at the Monroe Institute, and for about 10 years, I helped to train the remote viewing program with Skip Atwater, who was the former captain of the Fort Meade, Maryland Stargate program. Now, over the years of when it started out, the initial program, it was called Scan 8, and then it became Drill Flame and various other names until finally it was called Stargate or Project Stargate, which, you know, long before there was a Stargate movie or Stargate series, there was this secret program called Stargate. And interestingly enough, they what they were doing is they were putting people's minds into the Matrix long before there was a movie Matrix. So it has a kind of a wonderful little spin to it. One of the things that I want to mention about this, and you know, so I spent probably in total with various personnel from the original Stargate program, I probably spent a month or a couple of months in training, because I wasn't, you know, they thought that I had this ability and I wasn't convinced about it. And I was my own worst enemy, you know, when it came to this, until I just let go and, you know, stopped trying to make it work and let it work.
What kind of training was involved?
Well, it could be, you know, usually like about a week at a time, and where I would spend time with, you know, various members of the, you know, some were weekend programs and things like that. Many or a number of the original Stargate members from this military establishment began to teach it after the program was folded, ostensibly. And so I spent, you know, it'd be about basically part of it became as a recommended portion of it was to attend the Gateway Voyage program at the Monroe Institute, because they began to, what happened and where this correlation or this, you know, connection between the this top secret program and the Monroe Institute is when Captain Atwater, back in the early days, had heard about this hemisync that Bob Monroe, he had read Bob Monroe's book and thought, hey, this might be good for remote viewers and for our program. So he went down to the Monroe Institute and met with Bob. And longer story short, they, you know, did an analysis or background with Bob and sort of enlisted him to help them out. And, you know, so they created at the Monroe Institute, they brought in like literally a busload of, you know, of candidates, if you will, from the Fort Meade, Maryland, from the Stargate program to go down to the Monroe Institute and take a special gateway program, which was about, you know, accessing their own consciousness, settling into that deep state of consciousness and using special hemisync sounds, patented sounds, in order to help them get into that state of consciousness. And so it became a recommended part of it. So the training at the Monroe Institute of allowing yourself or allowing oneself to move into these altered states of consciousness was a big help, along with the development and the processing of, and the movement, if you will, through the Stargate program protocol. And so after that, as I say, I became, I helped to teach the program with Captain Atwater at the Institute for almost 10 years, I think, and until Skep retired. And I found it really profound. And I teach the program, remote viewing, that became my focus because it was so amazing. In a single weekend, we could take a class of, you know, and of people and have them do amazing things, because this is an innate ability that we all have, all right? And I have now trained, I think, about 3,900 people or a little bit more than that in remote viewing. And I have seriously not found a single person who just didn't get it. I mean, obviously some were, you know, obviously more capable than others. It's like, you know, it's like everything else. It's like musical ability, for instance. Everybody can learn to play the piano, but only a few get to go to Carnegie Hall, kind of thing. And but it's an innate ability that we all have. And when we strip away, you know, our physical limitations, if you will, and allow this to open up, it's amazing what people can do. And I've seen some remarkable examples of human consciousness. And in a single weekend, people can, you know, move to a place where they can describe, you know, literally any person, place, or thing on the planet. The interesting thing about it, as I mentioned before, they thought that people that had near-death experiences had this extra ability. And so over the years, given, you know, my position at the Institute and being able to work with all of these amazing, you know, scientific people and remote viewers, I get access to a whole bunch of documents and papers and so on and so forth. And interestingly enough, you know, yes, people that had near-death experiences, some of them, you know, were definitely seemed to tap into this or move into that state of consciousness. One of the things that they discovered that surprised me at first is that adults who had been abused as children, whether that was physically or mentally or even sexually, that there seemed to be an extra ability that these adults had. And I've seen some of the reports where an adult might be telling a psychiatrist, well, when it got really bad, I would go into the wall. So they had discovered or found themselves disassociating from their bodies to move into this kinder, gentler place, if you will. And that seemed to be a pretty big aspect to it. And so adults who had been through trauma or through abuse as children seemed to have a great aptitude or ability to move into those states of consciousness. So I've seen over the years, I've seen some amazing, remarkable remote viewers that have trained who one young lady, I should explain this here. This is probably 10, 15 years ago here on Vancouver Island, and doing just a weekend workshop. And this young lady came, showed up. And the first time I met her, she walked into the room, and she's probably 30 years old, pretty blonde lady, walking with crutches. And she literally had to throw her hips to make her legs move for each step. And when she was a teenager, when she was 18, 19 years old, she was like an outgoing party girl with her friends and so on and so forth. And one weekend or one time, she got in a severe car accident and literally went almost overnight to sitting in her room in a wheelchair, being told, "You're never going to walk again." Well, what would you do? The same as what she did. And so, these people would go through different aspects in their own consciousness. And so they might go through and say, well, with disbelief, like, why is this happening to me? To anger, like, why is this happening to me? And then finally, even to self-pity, it's like, why is this happening to me? But the more time they spend in here, in their own thoughts, in their own consciousness, the more they begin to understand how they process thought. And this young lady was amazing. She blew my mind. I've had, now having said that, like her abilities were just like holy smoke, dead on. Having said that, I've had a number over the years of people that were just like remarkably astute, being able to not only describe it, some event or person, place, or thing, but actually name it. And these are blind targets, if you will. And there's evidence in all of the studies that we've done, and the remote viewing sessions that we do in workshops and things like that, double blind targets where a person is describing accurately exactly what happened, the people, places, events, and so on and so forth, looking into the future, that kind of thing. So it's beyond, it's beyond dispute. And the more and more, as you mentioned off right at the beginning, this is becoming more commonplace. We're being able to is using technology, using things like hemisync, in order to allow us to move into altered states of consciousness, to facilitate this movement of consciousness to examining, all the worlds around us. So it opens up the door to a whole bunch of amazing things. So now over the years, now I want to make this clear that I was, as a Canadian, I've never was employed by Stargate. However, I have helped out with intelligence services in teaching the program, if you will, and in, finding missing people, finding hostages, so on and so forth, searching for bad guys kind of stuff. So I just find it, I'm like, I feel like a 12-year-old boy again. Like I got this secret and holy crap, I want to tell it. It's so cool, right? And so I can't hide that kind of, exuberant, feeling behind it. So because it is so cool. And watching people in a single weekend being able to blow their own minds, saying, "How is that possible?" That to me is just so powerful and so wonderful.
Why do you think remote viewing works?
Well, it's not that I think it, I know it. because I've seen evidence of it so many times. I think because there is our truer sense of who we are. There is no limitation. There is, and this was, you know, Bob Monroe's, you know, one of his biggest acclamations was that, you know, there are no limitations. You know, we are connected, our consciousness is connected to everything, all thought, you know. So some remote viewers, many, many people, it can be like a human lie detector, you know, are able to pick up on the thoughts of people, you know, or the consciousness around the world, or predict the future, looking at the future. And so when we see it in things like, you know, and in remote viewing classes, I actually teach things like, I was hired for a while. I worked for an investment corporation in predicting the stock market. So it has some physical aspects about it as well. All right. So if you want to predict the future, now this is going to sound really crazy, but if you want to predict the future, you know how you do that? You wait until it happens, until it's written in time and history, and you send yourself the message back in time. And what? That's essentially what happens. See, our notion of time being a limitation is probably not correct, right?
Mm. Well, I mean, I kind of see intuition almost as a echo of a future outcome that you're anticipating and picking up on. I think of moments in my life where I've had very strong intuitive feelings about what I should do about certain situations. And then when I choose to do a particular action, I feel an extremely strong emotional response. Oh, maybe I made the wrong decision, or I made the right decision, and I get a very strong positive or negative response from that. And it makes me think, well, perhaps if all points in space and time are connected, if time itself is basically just one moment and we're operating in various slices of that one moment, then there is a future me, and there is a past me, and there is a present me, and that they're all connected, they're all entangled on the kind of, you know, quantum hologram of the universe. And I, to be honest, would resonate with that and feel that intuition is in some way you interpreting the future, and it's strong resonance of energy coming down that timeline. So very strong situations will have perhaps a stronger intuitive signature attached to them. So people who are very sensitive to those types of things, I imagine, can pick up very nuanced things coming from the future. But I think that most people, even if they don't realize it, have very strong gut feelings, very strong intuitive feelings, and they may not recognize what that is. But I think that it's probably you picking up in some way the waves coming through time of something approaching, and you need to start recognizing, okay, well, something's coming, so I better start getting ready for whatever that might be, and think about what I do with my decision making right now. And I think it's a very important aspect that's overlooked by modern science, that intuition informs a lot. In fact, intuition has informed a lot of the principles of modern science. Some of the greatest minds in science had intuitive dreams, had intuitive moments. Nikola Tesla, Einstein, you know, who's the guy that founded kind of like modern day rationalism? René Descartes, you know, all of these guys had intuitive or even mystical experiences that informed a lot of the scientific principles that we now use to discredit mystical experiences and intuition. So I find that quite interesting.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that, because what you touched on is probably one of the key elements to it. In remote viewing, what we teach basically is to your left brain, our brains will make up stuff, will lead us in the wrong direction, so on and so forth, because we want to figure things out. But your heart never lies to you. So anytime you've gone against your gut feeling, how has that gone? Not well, right? So exactly what you said, one of the biggest aspects of remote viewing is learning how to trust that inner feeling, that gut feeling, that core reaction to it. And in throughout our lives, we've discovered why, or when we ignore that, that we've learned some important lessons about it. So, and what we discovered in remote viewing, and that's essentially one of the things that we teach, is to move past your brain, which tries to figure things out from the left brain concept, and move into the right hemisphere of your mind, which is connected to the rest of the universe. But where it's exemplified or amplified more than anything else is in your heart or in your gut feeling. Like I said, your heart never lies to you. All right. Whereas your brain will make up stuff. Okay. So it's a very important aspect that you touched on. And using that concept, that feeling right here, is one of the, I think one of the key things with remote viewing as well. So it takes us to the truth, if you will.
Yeah.
Pretty much like you said.
So how would you describe your personal model for mind and its relationship to matter?
Oh,
I know it's not an easy feat, but give it your best attempt of just your general idea and perspective on the mechanics of mind and matter.
Wow. I think we are what we experience. And now I don't, I'm trying to come up with some intelligent thing to say, but I think one of the most important aspects of recognizing who we are is understanding that on the physical surface, like even dealing with other people, and this is one thing that I was going to mention here. When we're talking about remote viewing and we're talking about military intelligence, which, some people would argue is the biggest oxymoron in the world, military intelligence, right? But what they discovered back in the days of Stargate and Scandate and, Grill Flame and all of those things. And I got to meet all of these people, almost all of them, and work with some of them. And regardless of what the intentions might have been of the Joint Chiefs of Staff or the military establishment around this, for the people who were doing it, the people who were involved on an everyday basis, you could not find more spiritual people on this planet. Because they understood it from the heart place. They understood it from a larger consciousness level, which is inclusive of everything. And the understanding of who we are without the limitation of time and without the limitation of physical aspects. And having that understanding is knowing, I mean, the reality is we're still here and we have to deal with the damn world. We have to deal with the craziness in Ukraine right now and with the pandemic and all of the, insanity that surrounds that. But it's in being able to look past that, if you will, and to be able to have an understanding around that, that this struggle, what I've discovered, with the near-death experiences, excuse me, and the hundreds of out-of-body experiences, is there are no accidents, right? We came here voluntarily, and we came, and from what I've discovered after these many, many, many experiences, that we travel in a family of souls. So this time you might have been the son. Last time you might have been the mother or the father. And we travel in families of souls and we intermingle in each other's various lifetimes. And we agree to that before we come here. And we make agreements with each other to fill places in each other's lives. We also, probably the most important agreement that we make is to, we make an agreement with that soul who's going to come along and push every damn button we have. And you know who that is, right? And from the larger concept of it, regardless of how that interaction with that soul exists, like for me, it was my father, was that they actually agreed to do that out of love, to come here to help you understand a certain lesson. And putting that into perspective, I think is sort of, it might be hard on the physical aspects to take a look at and go, oh, okay. Harder than that. But I think in the reality, that's the truth of it. And then what happens also is we also make an agreement with a, if you will, a spirit guide who will come along to make sure that everything that we planned out is going to happen. And here's the reality from what my perspective. We didn't come here for the easy stuff. If we want easy, we stay on the other side. We come here to this physical life to challenge ourselves. We come here to get our asses kicked and our hearts broken. Because guess what? Then you know you're alive and you're fully experiencing this. And so we go through this, these different aspects. And even people in our lives that, you know, people that, say, for example, people who commit suicide, you know, that may have been the plan all along. Or that person may have said, well, if by a certain thing, I'm, you know, checking out, you know. But what we find is that for the most part, the folks who come along who are in our lives who commit suicide, if you will, it's for us. They're perfectly fine. They're back on the other side, right? It's for our learning and for dealing with our, you know,
how,
in our hearts.
How we respond to it, how we respond
right.
to it. Yeah, yeah.
So it's sort of in a larger way, we are consciousness connected to everything in the universe. And sort of we're here dumbed down for the meantime to try to learn specific lessons or things that we want, because you know, maybe on the other side, I mean, like I said, you know, if you want easy, stay over there. But if you want a challenge, if you want to, you know, if you want to have some fun, come over to the physical side, because this is where, you know, we're getting our butts kicked and our hearts broken. And also we are achieving the ability, and I think this is coming more and more with technology, like we talked about earlier on, to the point where we are able to tap into this in a very real way. You're using technology to tap into who we really are, a consciousness connected to the rest of the universe.
I think you and me have extremely, if not identical, kind of viewpoints on reality and how to view like, the concept of an afterlife and the concept of why we're here in this physical form. Everything that you were saying there, I was just kind of nodding my head along in agreement with, because this is what intuitively I have been informed upon with my own life journey. My own life experience has led me to those types of inclinations about what reality is. And, you know, this idea of, I suppose it's the fundamentals of love thy neighbor, that idea that you have to actually have a loving embrace of the duality of reality, because the yin and yang, the up and down, the hot and cold, the light and dark, this is all a necessary aspect of keeping this game going. We're here for this individualized experience where we can differentiate between our environment and we can choose our responses, and we have the free will to decide how we respond to situations. And so I agree with you. And one of the philosophers that I love to listen to, Alan Watts, I'm sure you're familiar with Alan Watts, he says a very similar thing, that we're all basically like actors on a stage, and that there are heroes and there are villains and there are everything in between, and the stage is so complex and the play is so involving that the you know, you truly believe that that is what is happening, that is the experience that is occurring at that time. But once the curtain falls and the actors return to the green room, everyone shakes hands. Heroes, villains, doesn't matter. Everyone shakes hands because it was just a play. It was just an act. But it's because we're down here in that physical experience, in the trenches of the physical experience. It's very hard for us as individuals to kind of zoom out of that and see the mosaic of reality being created, especially when things are happening in real time. You're having an argument with your spouse, you're having some sort of dispute. It's not easy for us to immediately kind of go, oh, this is happening for a divine purpose. It's much easier for us to just throw an insult their way. So we're learning. We're very low down on that developmental scale as human beings, and we're learning. But that is the, to me, that is the fundamental core of the human experience. It's to realize that we are fundamentally all one energy, all one experience. That's the process of remembering that reality as we go through life. And I think that life is in some ways a school, but I do think, like you, that we choose why we decide to come down here and what lessons we decide to learn. It's our own decision to be here and to experience what we're experiencing. And what a magical and also terrifying thing life is, you know. But I think that we're very much in agreement on that type of perspective.
Yes, I think so, totally. One of the things, you know, people will ask, well, what's the plan of my life? What's my purpose? Your purpose is to experience, from what I understand. But it can be as simple about, I mean, we think about it in, larger concepts and so on and so forth. But if we're traveling in families of souls, and we're sharing and we're contributing to this, this knowledge or, base of knowledge or experience, if you will, we can't, it could be as simple as, someone's purpose in life could be as simple as showing up and being there to say three words to somebody else that changes their life. And that might be the entire purpose of their life, their agreement to come along and contribute. All right. So for the rest of it, they're going along for the ride, but we don't know. And what I've discovered that's, probably relevant to everybody, when we talk about like guidance or spirit guides, if you will, and, and I've had so many experiences in my life where things, it can be like maddening, frustrating. And even in dealing with other people, we can't know another person's path. We can't. I mean, we can, ostensibly you can try to understand it, we can be told about it. And one of the experience, one of the things that, and these are life experiences that come to me. And many, many years ago, when I was in politics, and I was meeting with this other politician, and he was just a jerk, and we're having this discussion, and the guy who introduced me to him, and we're talking about this, and this guy, it was just like, you just want to like get out of my face, you're a moron, and the guy was a jerk, I thought. And so finally, I sort of bit my tongue and, understanding it, there might be some reason, whatever. Anyway, after the guy left, I just was discussing them with one of the other folks in the in this meeting, and I said, "What an asshole, what a jerk." And he stands up, "Yeah, I'm sorry. He just lost his 13-year-old daughter to cancer." And I'm like, oh my God, I'm the asshole. Wow. So we can't ever know. And so it's always what I found is that it's important to, and every time I forget or lose sight of that, I get reminded of it somewhere down the road that we can't know somebody else's path, and they're dealing with it maybe the best they can. Maybe sometimes there are just jerks in the world, and so on and so forth. But what I've discovered is that it's really important to, sort of give the benefit of the doubt, that we can't know somebody else's trip. And anytime, and it can be just the smallest, simplest things, when we talk about, well, yeah, where's my spirit guide when this happened? Spirit guide's hanging on, going, holy crap, that's gonna hurt. Right, looking forward to get back on the other side, going, holy smoke, man, when you ran into the wall that time, wow, that was cool. Because they get to experience that, they get to come along with that. And one of the things, and this is a simple sort of demonstration of that, of the uniqueness of it, there isn't a time when we are by ourselves, or psychically, if you will. There is always, a larger sense of us, whether it's our higher self or spirit guide or whatever you want to call it. And here's an example of that. This is several years ago, and I was doing workshops over on the mainland in Vancouver, the city of Vancouver, remote viewing workshops for the weekend, and then having to ferry, back, this hour and a half ferry ride back to the island. So I head off to Vancouver, do my workshop, and then ferry back to the island with my car and so on and so forth. So I'm finished up this workshop in Vancouver, in the city of Vancouver. And I'm trying, I got to catch the ferry because I do, there's like only so many ferries that run each day. And so I'm rushing like crazy through the city of Vancouver. I've only done this trip 100 times or more. And every there was, like there was some construction in the downtown core, and then I had a turn on this street and that street. And I'm driving around in circles, getting more and more pissed off at myself because I've only done this 100 times. I got lost, which is almost inexplicably stupid, And I'm going around circles, getting more and more cheesed all the time. I'm getting angry, like, I'm gonna miss the damn ferry, And finally, I'm driving, like 120 kilometers an hour on the, on the highway. And I get to the ferry and pull up to the gates, and they're closed, and I miss the ferry. And I was like, oh my, I'm just so angry, right? And so now I got to wait an hour and a half for the next ferry, or 2 hours. And so I can pick up my phone and call my girlfriend and tell her that, hey, I missed the ferry, and I'm, where's my phone? Where's my, I forgot my phone in the hotel. And I was so angry with, I wanted to slap myself to get my attention, And so I turn around and I'm whizzing back to the hotel, and I thought, oh wow, that was guidance. Thank you. I'm an idiot. Had I made the ferry, now I've got an 8 hour trip. I got to go over on the ferry and then come back on the ferry again and drive through the city of Vancouver, which the whole thing is going to be 6 to 8 hours. Instead of now, I just drive to the hotel and I get, and I'm delayed an hour and a half, pick up my phone. And it was those kind of where it just goes ka-ching, wake up. And the realization that we're not here alone, that, and I've had experiences in the past where my spirit guidance or whatever will come along and go, ah. And I can hear that inside or feel it going, oh yeah, okay, I'm an idiot. All right, I get it. Thank you. So we're on a, I think the biggest pathway, and this is what I, I get to travel all over the world and, and talk to many, many people. And I think one of the important things about consciousness, or this whole journey that we have here, and I think when you break it all down, at the end of everything, with the time we die, and when we're dead and buried and in the grave, it won't matter one little bit who won or who lost, or how rich or famous we were, or how important we thought we might have been. The only thing that will matter is how we treated others along the way. And we will go through, we'll all go through a life review at the end of this sojourn, and somehow every single thing that we've done in this lifetime, everything that we've thought and did, is somehow stored energetically on the other side for our benefit, for our review at the end of all of this. And so that's why I encourage people to, it really seems to be the things that will matter to us most is how we did this interaction with other souls. And notwithstanding the fact that some of us agreed to come here to be a lesson for others. So some of us have agreed to put ourselves in our own little hell, if you will, on the other side, so that the rest of us can learn a lesson. So being able to sort of put that all into, into balance, seems like a, a crazy notion sometimes, but it's the only thing that makes sense, is how we treat others along the way.
Yeah, I agree with that. I agree. And certainly got a few black marks on my record for the review when it comes to the end of life, but I've done my best as a humble human, and I think that the sooner you can realize that that is probably a component of life, the sooner you can really try your best to embrace that in the most difficult of situations, because that is when it's most important. It's easy for me to love my mum, and it's easy for me to love, the people around me who I'm always caring for, but it's not so easy to love someone who suddenly gets up in your face and annoys you or frustrates you. And I think that is the truest challenge, but also the, the most significant reward of being a human, is that ability to have a loving exchange and to bring that energy forward. And I think that there is a lack of that in the world, but it's certainly, the same as you. My own kind of journey through life has just had too many little synchronistic, intuitive moments for me to feel like there isn't some level of guiding hand, whether it's my higher self. There is something about life that is just too mysterious for me to just dilute it down, because I. I'm quite an analytical person, but I think I've got a good dose of creative, intuitive intelligence and analytical intelligence. So I like to break things down, but I do recognize that there is, I think for me, it's about science is always operating on a foundation of ignorance, because as long as we are unaware of the creative processes required to form our universe, for example, we're studying the effects of the Big Bang, but we have no way of studying the cause of the Big Bang, not through any objective tool or scientific medium at our disposal. These mysteries lie beyond the event horizon of the scientific limitations. And I think this is where the mystical or the spiritual or the intuitional intellect comes into play and has this ability to, I suppose, in some ways, kind of penetrate through the materiality of our dimension and catch small glimpses of what lies beyond it. And the sooner we can refine our methodologies and our technologies so that they can explain objectively what has been explained intuitively by, our most revered spiritual advisors, and also just through our own lives, the sooner we'll change the direction of humanity for the better. And that's where I think that we might be going with this symbiosis between science and spirit, is that eventually we'll be able to satisfy even the most skeptical mind that there is a spiritual energy to nature and to reality.
Yes, totally. I totally agree with that. The one of the things that we were, and I think this is probably, the intent, if you will, or where we're moving with this now, and it may be moving further towards, the larger concepts of, consciousness and who we are, and the fallacy of thinking perhaps that, gee, we're the only intelligence in the universe. That's a pretty sad universe, So one of the things about remote viewing as well, you were asking about that, and that I think are really profound. And I got to do some sort of official, if you will, kind of remote viewing regarding extraterrestrials and things of that nature. And there's no question about it. We have some very interesting folks. Paul Hallier, I think Paul has now passed on. Paul was the Canadian Defense Minister of Canada for a number of years. And Stephen Hawking, one of the fellow in the the intellect in the wheelchair, who had some challenges there. Stephen had made some statement about extraterrestrials and something to the point of, well, if there was a possibility of, being intelligence in the universe other than us, that, and then if they could somehow overcome this movement through millions of light years of travel to be here now, that we should be really, really worried, and they would likely be here to rape our planet of its resources, and we would be like ants compared to their abilities. And a couple of weeks after that documentary came out, the Canadian or former Canadian Defense Minister Paul Hallier was speaking, I think, at the Ottawa Press Club, and someone asked him about that. And Paul kind of unloaded on him, and he said that that's one of the dumbest things that, that he's heard. He said, the reality is they're here. They've been here for thousands of years, and he's, and said, where do you think we're getting the technology that we have today? And this is the reality of it. And this is where it's coming in, pieces of that. But it's not like ET is here saying, oh, no, silly, turn this screw in here and do it, blah, blah, blah. They apparently have, some artifacts, that human beings are trying to, do reverse mechanics on. But I got to do some remote viewing in relationship to extraterrestrials, and I think it's so, such an exciting portion of who we are, and we're seeing more and more of it all the time. You see, here's the reality, and this is why the topic becomes a little bit polluted, is who stands to lose the most if ET is real? Fundamental religion, right? How does that work? And in concepts of religion, that'll sure mess things up if all of a sudden What about these guys who show up, all right? Well, the reality is they've been here for thousands of years, and I think we're in really fortunate times. I think that we are just a few years away from the literal landing on the lawn, if you will, where it's like full disclosure and so on and so forth. And I think this is a really important part of it because I'm having been raised as a Catholic, you know, and we know some, you know, so we have, you know, even in terms of the Catholic Church, they know some things. The Catholic Church is a sovereign nation, right? You know, and so when the Catholic Church comes out and says, like they did, makes a statement like they did a few years ago, saying the existence of extraterrestrials wouldn't necessarily be outside of the scope of Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
You know something's
coming. Why do you think they're doing something like that, people? It's because they absolutely... I agree with you. And, you know, as someone who's within the UFO research community, you hear this a lot of the time. And it wouldn't surprise me whatsoever that the Vatican had a more sophisticated level of knowledge than the public, and perhaps even more than the governments in this regard. But I'll tell you, all I know from my own personal experience, and I have no evidence for it, only my own subjective evidence, but and this is in relation to the UFO issue, because it's what kind of catalyzed my interest and it really caused me to create the platform that I'm now interviewing people like yourself on. But, you know, all I know for sure is that there is some non-local component to human consciousness. Your thoughts, your intentions, they have the ability to in some way be projected through space and time. How this truly works, I don't know, but I imagine it's done through utilizing the energetic networks that make up space and time, and that human beings are complex enough in their ability to render and utilize energy that we can basically express not only self-awareness, but we have the ability to send, like a computer, packets of information across the universal network. And the other thing that I know for sure is that there is some form, and I don't know what it is, but there is some form of non-human intelligence that can respond to specific signals or frequencies that can be generated by human beings. I know this is true because I've experienced it for myself. I would never profess to truly understand the implications of what I've experienced, because the more I've learned, the more I've realized just how little we know as a species. But what I have seen for myself, and this took the form of orange orbs of light that came down and hovered over my house, and I saw them on a few different occasions in various formations. And this came about from me being in my back garden, looking up at space, getting into a meditative state of mind, and very coherently and clearly projecting my intentions that I wanted to see something, that I wanted evidence that there was another intelligence out there, you know, something out there that can understand me or understands that consciousness and love are at the root of all things, respond to me, and like basically just echoing those kind of thoughts out and sending those types of thoughts out. And I got these responses. And so I know that there is something out there that responds to these signals. I would never begin to say that I know what it is, but it's something, it's real, it's tangible, it's there. And so this fascinates me. Like this, the UFO situation fascinates me, but the undeniable interconnectedness of consciousness and this phenomenon that we call UFOs, that to me is just a profound, the implications of that are so profound.
Yeah, very, very much so. I got, you know, in working with some of the folks in, you know, in Stargate and, you know, other, you know, amazing remote viewers around the planet, I got to do some targeting and remote viewing that had specifically to do with extraterrestrials. And my experience opened up sort of a whole myriad of things similar to what you were talking about, you know, where, you know, I've had the experience before. And where this first came about is I was at the Monroe Institute taking a program there. And I can't remember which one it was. This is, you know, a number of years ago. And we had finished up in the evening, probably about 9 o'clock, 9:30 in Virginia. And we'd finished up and I'm laying in this, in my little booth, if you will, with the headphones still on, thinking, okay, should I go downstairs and have a snack, or should I just drift off to sleep? And I'm just laying there, and I feel this vibratory change, and all of a sudden, I am looking out of, you know, and I hadn't even contemplated anything to do with, you know, extraterrestrials or, you know, spaceships. And this sounds weird, but suddenly I was on a spaceship. And I'm looking down over top of a large city at night, probably from, it looked like about 40,000 feet, a little higher than you would normally see from aircraft, over this vast city. And looking out of this huge window, and there was one of them on either side of me, the little gray guys. And I didn't look at them, but they were showing me this. And I'm looking at this, and I so distinctly remember the color of the walls was like, you know, this, you know, sort of a light blue color. And I'm looking around here, holy crap, holy, I'm in a freaking spaceship. My mind is screaming. And I'm seeing some huge monitor kind of reminded me of monitors on the wall. And inside, I'm going, oh my God, I'm in an effing spaceship. And boom, I'm back in my body, vibrating. And I thought, holy crap, that was real. You know, and so I didn't pay, you know, I mean, obviously I didn't sleep much that night, but I thought, holy crap, that was cool. And they didn't talk to me, but they were showing me this. And I was, you know, I was surprised because in my, you know, mind, I thought a spaceship would be a little thing. We'd have to crouch over to look out. And this was vast. It was just huge, you know, like probably the ceiling was probably 15, you know, feet high or more. And so I, you know, contemplating this and thinking about it and, you know, forget about it. And then about 3 months later, I'm back home in my home in Swift Current, Saskatchewan, where I was the mayor of this small city for a whole bunch of years. It was, like I mentioned before, it was an interesting dichotomy, if that's a word for it. I'm like living two lives or two life, you know. I was the mayor of a fundamental Christian community. 80% of the residents of Swift Current, Saskatchewan were probably Mennonite, right? And, you know, so I'm living this double life.
Yeah, you're like the secret psychic on the side.
Right, right. So I can't, it's like, you know, and yeah, they heard about those near-death experiences, but that ain't Jesus, you know. And if you talk about out-of-body experiences, well, you are the devil.
Let me, can I quickly ask, why do you think that is? I've always been interested by that. Why do you think that the knee-jerk reaction is to assume something like that is satanic?
Well, not necessarily satanic, but it would be, well, because that's the basis of the religion. Is there is Jesus, or there's, you know, there's God and everything else, and you know it's the, you know, the physical constraints of the religion itself. Okay,
yeah.
And anything else outside of that, well, that's, you know, that's unbelievable or beyond their belief system, and so they will, you know. Anyway, I was very careful. You know, because I mean, I'm literally living a double life. So, you know, by day, I'm the mayor of this fundamental Christian community. And at night, I'm doing intelligence work, you know, messing around with, you know, psychic trails and, you know, stuff like that. And so it was, I, you know, never could talk about it, especially not around election time, right? And I managed to make it through several elections. So, but it was always sort of an interesting dichotomy. So I'm back in my, this is like 3 months after this experience at the Institute in Virginia, where all of a sudden I'm in a spaceship and I knew it was real. And I'm in bed with my wife. This is, you know, a couple of months later, and I become aware as I'm crashing, I'm coming in through the roof of my house. I'm out of body and I slammed into my body in bed, and I know somebody's followed me. And I'm lying there and I cannot move and I cannot speak. I'm just, you know, what's the word for that? Locked up.
Paralyzed.
Yes. Dream paralysis, basically. That's what happens to us. Seriously, every single night as we drift off to sleep, we move into sleep paralysis. As soon as our bodies, or as soon as our minds drop into theta range of consciousness, where the dream states begin to start and so on and so forth. We actually move into dream paralysis or sleep paralysis, and we get locked up. And that's to keep us from acting out our dreams and hurting ourselves or others. So this is a completely natural condition that every being on the planet goes through when we're in theta range. So anyway, I'm locked up. I cannot move. And I know there's somebody in my room. And so I turn, and because I'm laying in bed, and there he is. It's a little guy. You know, our concepts of, you know, a little gray ET standing beside an armoire that had a television in it beside my bed, about 7 or 8 feet away. And I want to yell or something, and I cannot. And I'm just looking at him, and he looks at me and goes, and he turns and walks right through the wall. And then instantly I can get up and I go, whoa, wait, I would want this. Why? I couldn't believe it. Like, you know, why was I all, you know? So I ran out in the living room, excuse me, where this being would have gone as he went through the wall. And there's nothing there. And it's like 3 o'clock in the morning. I'm out front on the steps of my house in Swift Current, Saskatchewan, yelling at the sky, saying, no, come back. Because I would want that more than anything else. And I was so disturbed as to why I couldn't move. And so have you heard of a fellow called Whitley Strieber?
Yes, yes. I'm hoping to interview him at some point soon.
Yeah, Whitley has written a number of books. He's sort of the consummate experiencer, if you will. Whitney had moved people from, you know, being abductees sort of thing, that notion, to contactees, which is a lot more accurate. All right. I'm not sure about the abductee monikers. So I knew Whitley, and Whitley wrote a number of books, one called Communion, which was made into a movie, you know, which is basically about ET, you know, kind of stuff. And I called Whitley the next day and I said, Whitley, what the hell? I was frozen. And he explained it. He said, well, what's happened over millennium or whatever timetable or time period we're on, is that the grays, if you will, and there's many, many different species that, you know, move through our zone, if you will. But he said, what's happened over the many, many years is they've developed the ability to change their vibration to such an extent that they can pass through solid materials.
Yeah.
So they really don't need a spaceship other, you know, the spaceship is to carry the luggage, but they can literally transport themselves anywhere. And so, but he said, what happens is because they understand the human condition where we shoot first and ask questions later if we're threatened. And so being that they were in that transition that they've had, being able to change their vibration to move through solid objects and things like that, that they have lost a tremendous amount of muscle power and ability. And so we can hurt them so easily. So what they do is they invoke this dream or sleep paralysis. They lock us up, you know, so that we can't hurt them. And so that made sense. And after that, I've had, you know, but it unleashed a number of memories of when I was a kid, of experiencing, watching a UFO and different lights in the sky and stuff like that, and just opening up a whole bunch of things. So I actually got to do some sort of official remote viewing, if you will, or semi-official remote viewing on extraterrestrials. And it's sort of like in your country, in Britain, where, you know, sort of the home of the crop circles. There are many, many, many in Canada as well, mostly on the prairies. But we have some large areas where they're, you know, ET or extraterrestrials are predominant. This was a hidden target that I got, or a hidden target without, you know, even a target number, of sort of like, you know, double blind or a blind target. And the target was crop circles, right? And you know who does the crop circles? This came out of my remote viewing. extraterrestrial teenagers. It's graffiti. And essentially, they're not supposed to do it and they get in trouble for it. But it's like, it's Friday night. We got the keys to the Volkswagen. Hold my beer. Watch this. All right. And so much of that now, and it sort of evolved over the years, becoming more and more amazing constructs or constructions in crops, whether it's in Britain or in Canada, wherever it is, that miraculously occur overnight. Those are real. And it's not Fred and Barney with a piece of binder twine and some plywood. It would take a month of Sundays to do some of those. And frankly, if you tried to do that in Saskatchewan on a farmer's field, you'd get shot because that would cause thousands of dollars worth of damage. And there's some very famous footage or video out of the UK showing at night some balls of light dancing over a field. And then a black helicopter comes along and chases them away. And then the next morning, there is this huge crop circle, right? How did that happen? So I've got to meet some amazing people over the years, not the least of which was a gal named Beverly Trouch, who was the considered to be the expert on crop circles in investigation. And she was on like 50 some radio and television programs discussing crop circles, and she was a former president of MUFON as well. And I met her at a remote viewing workshop, and she came to visit in Canada here, and we had some remarkable experiences here in Canada while she was here. Not the least of which was, going past or seeing a spaceship underneath the water in Cameron Lake, which is just close by here. Vancouver Island, by the way, is a fairly a fair hotbed of extraterrestrial activity, if you will. And it's related to this is one of the things, since we're talking about extraterrestrials here. One of the things that while I was at the Monroe Institute teaching the remote viewing workshop there with Captain Fred Atwater, one of the things that came out or came about is the CIA or Army Intelligence Services or whatever released some information. They released information on super top secret remote viewings of extraterrestrial bases on planet Earth. This is, oh, now it's almost 10 years ago, I think.
Yeah, I've come across this. I've come across this before.
Yeah, well, it's real. They released the data. The data that they released was these remote viewings, super top secret remote viewings, or formerly top secret remote viewings of extraterrestrial bases on planet Earth. And there were, at that time, a guy named Pat Price was that I mentioned earlier. Pat was one of the earliest and profoundly, acrid remote viewer. And over the years, they Pat described these four specific locations on planet Earth, and there's others. There's others, some in the ocean, but these one was in Mount Hayes in Alaska, and another one in South Africa, another one in Australia, and around the world. There was four specific ones, which were sort of underground bases, if you will, in mountains or wherever it was, like in Mount Hayes. And over the years, they bounced us off several other remote viewers, as blind targets. And these remote viewers, like Joe McMonagle, for instance, in Virginia, describing basically the same thing that Pat Price described. Now, the I actually have the slide presentation of that. And we were so astonished that they're releasing that. Wow. And so they actually have a slide presentation that goes along with it, showing the actual remote viewings of these various people, including Pat Price from back in the 70s, and then Joe McMonagle in the 80s, and so on and so forth, describing extraterrestrial bases, purpose, intent, and all of those things. And we just sort of, gobsmacked that, holy crap, they're releasing this. Wow. So that leads me to believe, what's the reason for that? They're opening the door. And recently we saw, you know, like whether it was the Navy or whatever, whether releasing the Pentagon releasing documents, releasing video of, you know, extraterrestrial encounters with Navy pilots and so on and so forth. So I seriously believe that the time is coming. We are within years of the landing on the lawn.
Well, I hope you're right. I mean, people within the UFO community have been waiting for about 70 years, so they'll be very relieved to see that landing happen. But I think you're right. I'd love to know, when you look at the UFO issue, what is it that you feel it represents? Because there are lots of interpretations. Obviously, you've got the more traditional extraterrestrial interpretation, aliens from another star system using advanced technology. There are those that believe that the majority of it, if not all of it, is classified government black budget technology that's been worked on for decades. There are the more spiritual interpretations that view them as our cosmic brothers and sisters, that they're here to assist humanity in some awakening process, spiritual enlightenment. And I suppose you even have the kind of Jungian approach that views the UFO issue as a psychic projection of the collective unconscious of humanity. So there are loads of ways in which this subject is dissected and interpreted. So I'm just wondering, I suppose, what your approach to this is.
Well, my understanding is that there are several different races, if you will. Excuse me.
We'll do another take on that, don't worry.
okay. Starting over. My understanding is that there are several races. From what I know about, there are four main extraterrestrial races, if you will, in the area, in the vicinity, and they've been here for thousands of years. There are two that are more specifically aligned or dealt with through intelligence services and so on and so forth, or folks who are in the know. And some people sometimes ask, well, in relationship to the ET, are they the good ones or the bad ones? Well, I don't believe that there are any bad ones, because the reality is, if there was an evil intent, we would be so toast, because we have no way of dealing with that. And if you have beings who have evolved to a place where they can be anywhere in the universe, overcome, you know, more than likely, they also understand the relationship that we were talking about before, about spirituality and connection through the universe, and that we are all, you know, part of this, and we can all communicate on that level. And so I don't buy the, you know, in that there are some evil beings there. Our notions of of being abducted as opposed to contactees, I think many, many of us have agreed to this long ago. And we already know this. This is a part of our process here, our, you know, in our own consciousness. So, you know, we are part of the plan. All right. And so many people will have had experiences as children, or like you had your experiences and I've had mine. But these aren't accidental or whatever. They, you know, they're it's not like abducting people, although, you know, there's some concepts about that, because anything that we know, we're the human race. So anything that we don't know, we're afraid of, and we want to, you know, shoot first, ask questions later, so on and so forth. I think it's just a very important part of our time and universe right now, or our place in time, where we become and move to that next level. Notwithstanding, you know, the the craziness that we still have going on our planet. But I think these are really exciting times to be alive right now, because some things are happening, becoming more aware. One of the things I mentioned was that, you know, if ET is real, who stands to lose the most? Fundamental religion, right? How does that fix in? How does that work into this whole process and plan? So I think these are very important times. and technology and everything else that we have that takes us through this and this connection to a larger concept, if you will, of consciousness connecting everything. one of the, this is years ago, and one of the commanders or one of the folks in the intelligence services, there were a couple of remote viewers who specifically, this is years ago, who had been targeting ET, remote viewing, doing remote viewing and telepathy with extraterrestrials and so on and so forth. And I wasn't there, but the, you know, the commanding officer at the time related this to me. And they actually set up a, you know, landing on the lawn kind of meeting, you know, a firsthand physical meeting between or with these couple of remote viewers who had been, you know, working on, you know, the telepathy with remote, with the extraterrestrials. They had set that up. And from my understanding, what he was telling me is that one of the ET, and I think these were the Greys, had been the remote viewers trying to ask him in the physical sense, how do you do this? How do you come? Where are you from? And how do you get like millions of light years of travel to be here? And ET sort of backing away saying, well, you won't understand. And the remote viewer is pushing this point and saying, well, no, 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 please, you got to tell me. How do you do this? And the remote and the ET finally says, well, you're aware of your Rubik's Cube? He says, so imagine you're here and we're here. We simply do this. And they're like, oh my God. So he was indicating that what they do to some degree is changing the dimensionality, changing dimensions. It's just like, okay, click, 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 there we go. And maybe that process can be that quick. Now, earlier I was telling you about talking with Whitley Strieber, where Whitley said, well, you know, what's happened is, you know, is they've become having this ability to increase their vibrations, pass through walls and so on and so forth, that they've become, you know, very muscular, you know, and very weak. And so we are a real threat to them. And where that kind of hit home for me was a couple of years after that. I'm watching the members from the space station, and a Canadian fellow named Chris Hatfield, who, you know, had his guitar or whatever up in the, you know, up in the space station or wherever, or, and was doing a little bit of a concert with the Bare Naked Ladies from the space station. And Chris Hatfield is Canadian, so they arrived back. They come back on a Soyuz flight or something like that, and they dropped down into the desert somewhere in Russia or wherever it is. This is, you know, a few years ago. And they pulled them out, these three guys, they pulled them out, a couple of Americans and the Canadian guy. They pulled them out and they sit them in lawn chairs, you know, over in Russia. And then the media are there to take their pictures and so on, ask questions and so on and so forth. And one of the things that the Canadian astronaut, Chris Hatfield, said, caught my attention, because, I mean, here they are, they're landing and so on and so forth. And I thought, you know, and they asked him one of, you know, and one of the things I think he said is that, if I remember correctly, one of the most profound things about landing back on Earth in gravity, moving from this place of no gravity where they do exercises and everything else, try to keep up their muscle tone, and they get here and they can hardly move. They can't walk even, you know, just barely. So they haul them around in lawn chairs and then, you know, shuffle them off to Houston to go through a reconditioning program when they're back here on Earth. And one of the things that Hatfield said just sort of got my attention, reminded me about the ET situation. And he said one of the most profound things was the weight of his tongue in his mouth. You know, holy crap. It was like, holy moly, what is that, right? And if you think about it, so it's going from this weightless place to a place where you've got to have muscles to get up and so on and so forth. And it occurred to me, and I went, holy crap, yes, of course. E.T. spends his entire life, perhaps, in a weightless environment. That's why they're weak. That's why they lock us up, you know, through, you know, the dream or sleep paralysis, theta paralysis, if we are in there. They can deal with it in two ways. Extraterrestrials can deal with us in a psychic way or in the physical, all right? In an out-of-body sort, in an energetic way, we can't hurt them, so they can treat us like equals. But if we are in the physical body, they lock us up for their protection. And so this makes sense because they spent their entire lives in a weightless environment, if you will, or generally speaking. So it, you know, would open that up. And I completely forgotten what we were talking about now.
No, I think we were just going off on tangents, which is exactly what this is all about. It's about having a conversation on these things. And I think that a lot of these ideas around extraterrestrials and the kind of physics that they may operate in, it certainly explains a lot of the stories that you hear. I mean, like you were saying, the shifting through walls is not something that is non-typical. It's actually described quite frequently. In fact, one of the most, I guess, prominent people who is given a story like that, I don't know if you're aware of a man called Jim Semivan?
I'm not sure.
So Jim Semivan's a CIA officer. He was, I can't remember his specific position, but he was a very high-ranking CIA officer, and he's played a pretty strong role in the UFO subject coming out of the US government over the past few years. So when the New York Times did this big story about the Pentagon's UFO program called ATIP, and there was all of this, news being generated about the UFO disclosure that might potentially be coming, there was a company that was formed called To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science. And To the Stars Academy of Arts and Science had a lot of the guys who were talking about the US government's involvement in UFOs within it. So Lou Elizondo, who's the man that you might have seen on the news talking about the Pentagon and its involvement in UFOs, he was in To the Stars Academy. And Jim Semivan was also an integral part of this this company. So he's a CIA officer who has an extremely keen interest in the UFO phenomenon. And he not too long ago confirmed publicly what a lot of people had known privately, which is that he had had an experience with beings that were like alien greys, and that this was very similar, a sleep paralysis experience at night, and they phased through his wall, and they literally came into the room just through the walls. And there's so many stories like that, and I think that whatever these creatures are, they just seem to have this ability to, I guess, reduce the spin rate of their own atomic structure, their own quantum structure, so that the physicality of it just becomes reduced. I kind of liken it to this idea of spinning a bike wheel really fast. And obviously, the faster you spin that bike wheel, your hand will just bounce off it if you try and put your hand through. But you slow that bike wheel down, eventually you can just put your hand straight through it. So the same concept, I think, applies to the kind of like spin particle physics that might be involved in being able to phase right through a wall somehow, and perhaps it's through consciousness, they're able to just reduce the physicality of their being and phase through objects. So I find that absolutely, absolutely fascinating. And you know, this is a story that's been echoed by many experiences, including CIA officers. So it's certainly something to take seriously. Shall we jump into some questions from the community? Because, I asked my Patreon subscribers to submit some questions for you, and I put out a message on Twitter inviting people to ask questions, and I got quite a few submissions, so we won't be able to go through each and every question, but I've picked out some of the best ones. And for everyone listening, by the way, if you want to join a fast-growing social hub of researchers who believe in freedom of discussion and have a desire to know the truth about our world and the way it works, consider signing up to our Patreon membership and gain access to the Unity Community Discord server. We have some amazing people in the server. It's a place to learn, it's a place to laugh, come check it out by becoming a Patreon. Links can be found in the description box below. So we had some really great questions submitted. First comes from one of our Patreons, Henry, who asks the following. Why do remote viewers need a number to initiate their session? What is the meaning of using numbers and coordinates?
Well, the truth is they don't at all. Originally, the program itself, they used geographical coordinates, so it'd be longitude, latitude, somewhere in the world, you know. And they would use those as target numbers, a geographical coordinate of a designated place. And the remote viewer would simply respond to that. They didn't need the number. And so what happened is, you know, many years ago, a number of years ago, when the Stargate program had to sort of re-qualify for funding every year, with Congress and so on and so forth, and the DARC programs. And Ingo Swann did a demonstration for the Joint Chiefs of Staff or whoever it was, and did a remote viewing demonstration in the actual targeting that Ingo knew nothing about, and just given geographical coordinates, was the Bikini Atoll, where they did the first atomic bomb test or whatever, explosion. And Ingo was given those geographical coordinates and sat in front of all these generals and stuff, and, you know, and drew pictures of palm trees and an island and sand and salt water, you know, and pretty much nailed it. You know, it's an island in the Pacific, you know. And some old general at the at this particular meeting said, "Well, that's a crock. Everybody knows the longitude, latitude, such and such is Bikini Atoll." And they went, "Huh?" You know, so they called it the memorize the coordinates of the globe trick. Which would be, you know, how many coordinates are there? How many billions and billions, you know, just sort of. So what that did, though, is it pressed Ingo Swann to say, we don't need no damn coordinates. You can make up random numbers and use it. In fact, you don't need a target number at all. And I have been faced with that a number of times where I've been actually doing operational kinds of targets, and maybe it might be a missing person or something like that. And the first time, actually, strangely enough, the first time we did that actually involved extraterrestrials, in which the tasker said, you know, I said, well, have you got a target number or something? And he goes, oh, shit, you don't need a target number. Just tell me what I want to know. And I thought, oh, okay. And so what I did, I thought, well, that'll be my target number. What does he want to know? And then I thought, no, I'm going to change that. The target number is what does he need to know, which might be entirely different than what he wants to know. And it was a very successful session. So the reality is you don't need target numbers at all. It does, it helps to occupy the left brain, all right? With boring, it's basically remote viewing is about, you know, putting yourself into a boring, menial task. Some of the best remote viewing that you can do, and people, to move into that place away from the physical, where you are sort of unrestricted, all right? We do that every single day. It might be mowing the lawn. It might be, you know, and here's a good example of it, driving the car, you know. In Canada here with vast open places, you can drive for 2.5 hours. And what happens? Your left brain gets occupied with the driving the car stuff, which allows you to move into the right hemisphere of your mind, which is connected to the rest of the universe. So some of my best remote viewing was, you know, would be like driving the car or mowing the lawn. It occupies the left brain, allows you to move into the right hand, the right, you know, hemisphere of your brain or your mind, which is connected to the rest of the universe. So the reality is that it's mostly just for physical, what's the word for it? You know, using an actual target number is to be able to document something.
Right.
Really, yeah. Is irrelevant.
Yeah. Patreon member Mitch wants to know if you're close friends or close colleagues at all with Dr. Hal Puthoff.
I know Hal Puthoff. I've met him. I'm friends with, excuse me, I've met a number of those people. I met actually met Ingo Swann only once, and that was a number of years ago. We're not close friends, but he's a wonderful guy, and I've met him a few times.
Next question comes from Patreon member Max Power, and they want to know if the Gateway process and all the historical CIA involvement is still discussed around the Monroe Institute.
There really wasn't a CIA aspect to it. Bob Monroe created the Gateway program for the ordinary person to experience and expand a state of consciousness. And what happened is the intelligence folks thought, hey, that could be very helpful for the remote viewers. So they had them basically go to Virginia and take part in the Gateway program, and found it to be very helpful for their process.
Yeah, they kind of jumped on it. I didn't realize that, first of all. I thought that the Monroe Institute and the Gateway process was a part of the contracted studies by the CIA, but I know that was mainly Stanford Research Institute. So I didn't realize actually that the hemisync was something that they just discovered was out there in the world and thought, "Oh, that might be a useful tool to add to our tool belt." So that's interesting. The next question we have comes from Patreon member B, who wants to know if you or anyone that you know of has engaged in remote viewing and, oh, well, we've already discussed this, has ever encountered what they believe to be non-human intelligences during the sessions. So you most certainly have told us a few stories now of non-human intelligence encounters during remote viewing sessions.
Yes, definitely. Mm. I would say many, many, many of them. The definition really is hard to decide. What is non-human?
Yeah.
There are billions of souls who have never been in a human body, you know, that are part of our, you know, our connections to the rest of the universe. But very, very much so. I have, and I'm sure many, many others. It's talking about Hal Puthoff, although I've met Hal a few times, usually at our annual remote viewing conference kind of thing. But Russell Targ, the other sort of grandfather of remote viewing, is a friend of mine as well.
Docialis would like to know what the latest developments in consciousness-enhancing technology are. So what is the Monroe Institute working on these days? Is it still a development of the hemisync, or are there other things at play?
Well, I think the basic elements are really about realizing that we have no limitations, that human consciousness, or our consciousness, human or otherwise, has no limitations, you know, and whether we can move back and forth through time. And so really at the forefront of research is to develop programs or develop possibilities or frequencies or hemisync sounds that will facilitate larger or more directed experiences, whether that be remote viewing, whether that be looking at past lives, whether that be exploring a whole myriad of things related to consciousness, if you will. So it's there's always a wide open the technology is there to be able to refine and to move towards in certain directions as we move along to sort of hone in on certain aspects of consciousness, and so that will always take place and is taking place.
Rickster wants to know if, through the act of remote viewing, are you ever inadvertently sending a kind of psychic flare out into reality, and that perhaps this could cause other entities to become aware of your presence, and could this cause you to receive unwanted interactions from things we don't fully understand? So is remote viewing kind of almost sending a big signal flash out into the void, and could we maybe regret making that decision?
I'm not sure how to I don't think, I mean, you know, there are some people who, you know, might be concerned and saying, like, gosh, you're opening the doorway. You're going to let in some bad stuff. There is, and I think the bottom line of this in spiritual states is there is no being, spiritual being or whatever, psychic being, that is more powerful than us, than you. If someone wishes to do that, I mean, it would be from a physical level. The reality of who we are is that we are all connected in consciousness throughout the universe. And I've had my last near-death experience was the most profound of all of them, in which I experienced that connectivity to everything and to all consciousness. And there is nothing that I've discovered out there that can impose upon us. We are independent. We can just say, pardon my, we can be like the Ukrainians too. There is nothing that can, there's nothing more powerful than we are. There's no other being in the universe that can lord it over us. There may be, confused souls who are stuck in, in a time warp of some sort. Oftentimes, if you remember, an old movie called Ghost with Patrick Swayze and Whoopi Goldberg, where a ghost is trapped or stuck in the subway system, and for it doesn't know he's dead or whatever for a period of time, and just wants a cigarette so bad, right? Well, I've actually discovered or had an experience, one an out-of-body experience, in a bar where this ghost of an alcoholic was there trying to get into the consciousness of this old drunk guy who was sitting there in the bar. And this ghost repeatedly would try to get in there, but he ejected immediately, right? Trying to get high off of this guy, So the reality is, what I discovered from that is we got to deal with our shit while we're here, because apparently it's hard to get a good joint on the other side, or a good drink.
That's good. I like that. Clive Watson wants to know if remote healing is something that's ever been looked into.
Very much so. The reality is that, I mean, this happens all the time. Our intent in sending love to someone, sending healing to someone. Here's a philosophical question that we sometimes ask. All right. The philosophical question might be, and I've had people ask this, where they say, okay, do you need permission to heal someone else? All right. And so typically people will respond and go, well, yeah. I get to meet some amazing people. And I met this Japanese Reiki master. And in Japan, they call it Malakari. And he was like, a high level Reiki master, or the master. I've never seen anybody or met anybody that was more powerful energetically. This guy could put his hands on you and you could feel the vibrations even without touching it. And he asked that question. And everybody, oh, sure, you gotta have permission. And sort of like, you cannot, and the reality is, and this is what he explained to us, you cannot heal a single person on this planet who doesn't want to be. Can you imagine if you had your plans that before you came here, that this and this and this is going to happen, and then, at the age of 56, you're going to die of cancer and head back home. And somebody healed you, you arrive home 20 years late on the other side, going, Jesus, what the heck happened here? Right? Not going to happen. All right. So the reality is, and it can be very effective. And this has also been studied by science as well, real scientific protocol, and using the numbers and everything else and placebos and things like that. What is the effect of prayer. What is prayer? Prayer is really, sending good intentions, all right, sending love. And so when we're doing things like if we want to distance healing, if we want to send, say, an emotional response to Aunt Becky, who's having some difficulty in the hospital or whatever, these are actually measurable things in terms of reactions. And they've done so much science on this, or so many different kinds of studies on it, that it does make a difference. Even prayer, if you will. Prayer is what? Prayer is essentially the same thing. Sending, what are we doing when we're sending somebody healing energy? We're sending them love, right? How they want to react to that or how they receive that is up to them. So we can't heal a single person on this planet who doesn't want to be healed, and rightfully so. However, it's that person's intent or receptivity that allows that to happen. All right. So when we're, and this is, the Japanese Reiki master who instilled this in me, said, when you're sending healing energy, what are you doing? You're sending love. You're sending caring and love. And he said, it's up to that person that's receiving that to either accept it or not. All right. One of the things that you may have heard about, there was a young fellow who was 14 years old, and it's called Adam Dream Healer. Adam McLeod is his name. And this is a number of years ago, for probably 12, 13, 15 years ago. There was a rock star called Ronnie Hawkins. And Ronnie Hawkins, he wrote a number of rock songs and things like this. He had been diagnosed with terminal cancer, this in Canada, I think. And he was basically sent home to finish up his last days. And one of his entourage or some of his family had heard about this 14-year-old kid in Vancouver, Canada, who did this or could do energetic healing from a distance. And so they got a hold of him. And so they arranged this. And at some point, this kid said, okay, between this hour and that hour, because they're on different sides of the country, so this kid works on him. And he worked on him, Adam worked on it in a fashion like where he described as like Pac-Man from the old games, where you had the Pac-Man. He would envision thousands of Pac-Man, sending these Pac-Man into the body, directed into the body of the recipient to go around and to munch up and attack all of the cancer cells and things like that. And within literally 3 weeks, Ronnie Hawkins was, he went back to the hospital and they found no signs of this cancer.
Wow.
And so and you can check this out. I had something to do with this. Adam McLeod was his name then, and they didn't, he had written a book called Dream Healer. If you Google Dream Healer, as a book or whatever, Adam McLeod, they didn't give his name back in those days because he was like 14, 15 years old. Now he is a doctor, a holistic doctor. And he would do, of course, he had a big following. His book sold a lot. And he had a big following where he would, be in Toronto and have like 800 people in the audience and basically taking them through this process, teaching these workshops about it, and with some real effect. So, absolutely, I believe that's, certainly a possibility. What I discovered in my time, because I have taken Reiki, after I was just sort of sold on everything after I began having these out-of-body experiences, and I thought, everything's possible. And so I took Reiki and I studied, different various forms and, and discovered thinking that, okay, well, I can envision sending healing energy to this person, this loved one, or this someone I don't know. Would it be more effective if I could go out of body to where that person is and give them Reiki, if you will? And I'm would that make it more powerful? You know, I'm not sure that it was more powerful for them, but it was for me. You know, but I think it's to the same effect. I think, you know, those intentions of love, but, you know, the person, the spirit of the person who's involved understands from the higher, a higher place that really there are no accidents and, you know, this is going to happen or it's not, you know, they're going to be on the other side or, you know, but there are no accidents.
Yeah.
Like I said.
Yeah. I think, you know, things like spontaneous, well, not spontaneous healing, but like remote healing or, you know, the act of prayer, of group resonance. I honestly think all of this is perfectly capable of being described by physics, by science. We're just not quite there yet in terms of being able to get into it from that lens. But all of these things, I believe, have a basis that can be explained in a way that's satisfactory to a traditional scientist. But it just we just need to get to that point in the human story. I think it's quantum entanglement on some level. I mean, I've experienced it very. I mean, I think the one person I've experienced the most of that with is my mum. You know, I have a very good relationship with my mum. I love her dearly, and she's on. You know, she's in a technically a different country, still connected to England, but she's in Wales, and so she's about, you know, 250, 300 odd miles away from me, and I will look at my phone going, oh, I think I'll message my mum, and she phones me. Like, the moment I pick up my phone starts ringing, and my mum's on the phone. Or if I'm having a really bad day, and then I'll get a phone call from her going, hey, are you okay? I just had a feeling I should give you a phone call. These things, you know, some people can brush that off and just say it's a coincidence. But for me, I'm like, no, that to me is that we share such a strong bond that there is a stronger level of entanglement, and that I pick up on her signals, she picks up on my signals, and that we're all able to do this, but maybe we do it in higher sensitivities with the people that we're most invested in energetically and emotionally. But this is a capability that I'm sure we share with everyone on this planet, and that we could connect emotionally with everyone on this planet if we had that level of resonance with each person that you have with your own mother or with your own father or with a sibling, you know.
Absolutely, I agree totally.
Yeah. All right. Well, with that, Paul, I just want to thank you for being so generous with your time and for having such a fascinating conversation, because I've really, really enjoyed this.
Oh well, my pleasure. As I mentioned before, I'm like a 12-year-old with a secret, and I just want to share it, you know. And you know, so I tend to talk too much sometimes, but.
Well, that's perfect for an interview, so that's fine by me. I can sit back and let you just you know, create the content for me, so there's no problem with having to talk too much. But no, it's been a really, really interesting conversation, and I'm sure we'll, you know, have more conversations in the future. For those interested, Paul has authored a book titled Eyes of an Angel, all about his near-death experiences and his personal journey through the fields of consciousness and spirituality. So a link for that book can be found in the description box below if you want to check that out, and I very much encourage you to do so. Paul, thank you once again for such an enjoyable discussion.